This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty, welcome to episode 27 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we have Jared Greenberg, the sideline reporter for NBA TV and the NBA on TNT. He also hosts NBA Crunch Time. Jared, thanks so much for taking some time to come on the podcast today, especially fresh off covering the Spurs-Thunder game last night where Victor Wembanyama and Chet Holmgren underwhelmed, I'd say, to say the least. But still, how was it getting to see Wemby up close?
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on, Brandon. I'm a huge fan of what Awful Announcing does, both on the pod and on the website and on social. So it's really cool for me to get an opportunity to chat with you guys, because I've been following you guys for years. And Brandon, you've always been a great supporter, so I thank you for everything. Last night was fun. As you said, both guys underwhelmed, but I think it gave us a glimpse into another budding superstar in Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. I don't know how many outside of hardcore NBA fans know just how good he is, and I think hopefully people saw that last night. But in terms of seeing Victor Wembanyama in person, like, he just doesn't look real with how big he is, how big his wingspan is and reach. You know, he's constantly like stretching and limbering himself up when he's not doing something on the court. So it's fascinating to see something that we truly have never seen before, at least at this level of consistency. And he's not even close to kind of popping, if you will.
Yeah. So then I think now Friday night, also you're back hosting NBA Crunch Time this week. And yeah, for those who don't know, it's a whip around show where essentially the NBA version of Red Zone. How many nights are you doing that this season?
So we're going to attempt to do more than 50, and which, you know, basically more than doubles what we've done in the past. And I think the potential to grow into even more is there for us. It's been such a cool year for us. We're setting all sorts of record numbers in terms of viewership. What's really been cool is to see how long people are watching as well. The retention rate has been awesome, which shows us that we're doing something. The feedback we're getting is that we're doing something that people have been craving for a long time in the NBA.
How is the preparation for that show? Like, how do you ready yourself to be able to narrate every live game at once? Is it mentally draining, like at the end of the night?
Yeah, at 1 a.m. when I'm laying in bed, like wide-eyed and, you know, wired and you know, just reviewing everything that happened in the day. It's the, you think back like, holy crap. But listen, it's nothing is hard. We're talking about basketball for a living, so I don't want to ever paint a picture that anything is difficult. It's my passion. I love doing it, but it takes a lot of work and preparation for me. Anybody who's young, up and coming in the business that's listening to this and loves to study the behind the scenes aspect of the business, prep is my number one pride in my work. I always say to people, they could find somebody better looking. They could find somebody with a better voice. They could find somebody with maybe a better background in basketball. They're not going to find anybody that's going to work harder and be more prepared than I'm going to be each and every, whether it's crunch time or for an NBA game I'm doing on TNT. So for me, the preparation starts with not waiting until essentially game day to start prepping, right? If you are hosting an NBA show, you've got to eat, sleep, and breathe the NBA every day. You know, I have an off day today, but I will be watching and studying the NBA, constantly checking headlines on Twitter, constantly reading articles, listening to podcasts. And then once game day hits, it's not starting from scratch. It's brushing up on what you need to know. And what I think people don't realize, kind of as you mentioned, Brandon, like, if there's 13 games, I'm prepping for 26 teams.
Right.
And it's learning the ins and outs of, you know, there have been times where I catch myself like doing like a real deep dive. I go down this rabbit hole of information. I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. I got, you know, 10 more teams still on my list to do. Let's back it off. I'm never getting to this content in tonight's show. Let's back it off a little bit and let's get to the stuff that may come up, or just be prepared for any scenario that does come up.
How many seasons have you been hosting it for?
Yeah, so it's an interesting topic, because we've had several different iterations of Crunch Time. It started about 7 years ago, where we would just do like a half an hour, an hour at a time on NBA TV. And then we kind of expanded it a little bit on NBA TV. Then we tried doing a whole night of it. If anybody remembers on NBA TV during the pandemic shortened season, we started off that year by doing Wednesdays and on Wednesday nights doing 7 hours of Crunch Time. So we would go from 7 p.m. until the last West Coast game ended. And we just found like that's not the sweet spot for what people are looking for. It's just they're, you're too much all over the place. So now we've taken the show to the NBA app. Occasionally we'll simulcast it if the night is right on NBA TV, but we take it on the app now. So we're into this iteration of it, where we've been doing this style of it now. This is our third season, but it's the most shows we've ever done. We are completely commercial free, usually for about 2 hours, sometimes a little shorter, sometimes a little longer, depending on the game schedule and how good the games are. And it's completely free to watch as well on the NBA app. So we've evolved over the years. We've done a lot of trial and error, and we feel like we're finally in the spot with being able to present to such a wide array of different types of viewers that has found a true sweet spot for where we need to be.
And what about for you as host doing it multiple seasons now? Like, how have you gotten better at hosting the show? Have you developed a sort of like flow or cadence in doing that?
Yeah, first, it truly starts off with, I don't think people realize, like, as much as I'm out front and I put in a lot of prep work, the work that our crew in the control room and in our tape room does every night is unbelievable. We have the best crew. I will stick our crew up with anybody that does production in television. Our producer, Bert Bondi, our director, Elisa Deans Davis, even our TD, John, has done some amazing work with creating how the boxes look, the transitions getting from game to game, allowing the viewer to know which game has the audio live on it. Our graphics people, our PAs, our guy in the tape room, Dan Eisner, who is just constantly selling different one plays or letting our producer know, hey, Steph Curry's on the court. He's back in the game. We got to get live to that game. So our researchers that are feeding me information in our Slack channel or in my ear, it's a full team effort. And our team, and this is what I think is really cool, like, and I think people have kind of learned this from inside the NBA a little bit, is that you can't develop a good product on TV or on the app, whatever it may be. You can't put out good production if every night you're switching in and out different team members, whether it's the host of the show, the producer of the show, the PA of the show, the guy back in tape. You've got to find some consistency in order to put out a consistent show. And I really thank our executive producer, John O'Connor, who's really spearheaded that whole effort to make sure night in and night out, we have the A team on this show. We found different things that work. We're willing to try things that, and see if they don't work, and we're okay if they don't work. And what, as you know, Twitter or X is great about giving us immediate feedback on it. Our friends, our family are great about giving us feedback, what they like, what they don't like, what they want more of, what they want less of. So, the biggest thing for me is knowing who's on the court, giving some context, and then letting the local announcers do the rest.
Have you ever spoken to Andrew Siciliano or Scott Hansen about hosting that type of show?
No, big fans of both of those guys. And obviously, you know, watch Red Zone a ton. And I was even, you know, this past Sunday over at his friend's house, and we're kind of sitting there looking at some things that Scott was doing, and just like, wow, like they're just so good, right? And they've set the blueprint. But what, you know, it's such a different show from what they do to what we do. And I don't think one is better than the other. I just think it's different. And I think people naturally, just because Red Zone's been around for so long and it's been, you know, a go-to, a staple for people in their lives on Sundays. It's a, they're not, I don't think people naturally think that the NBA fits this, but I think it fits it perfectly, right? Because we're not waiting for necessarily scoring opportunities, because there's a scoring opportunity every single time the ball is in play in the NBA. Right. And yes, we're crunch time. Yes, we pride ourselves on showing you the biggest moments, the close finishes, the great endings. But we're also, if we're on the air and the greatest dunk of the season happens in the first quarter, you're going to see it on our show too. And that could happen at any moment for us.
This is your 13th season with Turner, now yeah. Warner Brothers Discovery. Does it feel like it's been that long?
It does in some instances. I was just actually talking to a colleague of mine who I was, when I was hired, I was legitimately the youngest guy on air. There was a lot less of us 11, 12 years ago. And now I'm not one of the older guys, but I'm not one of the young guys anymore. And so it's interesting to evolve. But I went to Turner because I just saw the growth potential, and it has exceeded, to say my wildest imaginations and dreams, is not even scratching the surface of how crazy this journey has been over the first 12 seasons at Turner. It's been the greatest 12 years of my life, without question.
What were you doing before that?
So directly before being at Turner, TNT and NBA TV, I was working for MSG Varsity in your neck of the woods, Brandon, on Long Island. And we started back in 2009, at the time, the first and only high school sports channel in the country. And it was an MSG channel, and we covered high school sports like it was the highest level of anything in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. And it was so awesome. Some of the stuff we did with live games, with a highlight show that I would host in studio every night. It was just such a cool opportunity. We were there at the time for, you know, Kyrie Irving's announcement to go to Duke. We were there for the number one high school football program in the country in Don Bosco in New Jersey. We saw some great lacrosse out on Long Island and Connecticut and Westchester. It was just some of the coolest, you know, stuff to tell stories like this for people who really cared was so awesome.
Did you cover Kyrie in high school?
I did, yeah.
So, and does he remember you from that now that you cover him in the NBA? Does he know that you covered him in high school?
I have reminded him a few times. I don't think he remembers. Tobias Harris remembers. Karl Anthony Towns on occasion will recall some of those days that we had. But yeah, I don't think that's on the top of mind for Kyrie Irving.
Obviously, you've been with the inside the NBA crew, Ernie Johnson, Charles Barkley, Shaq, and Kenny Smith for a long time, but you being on the sideline and then being in the studio, is it more just like you guys are colleagues who work at the same company, or does it feel like you're a family on the same team?
So I think the term family is thrown around a little too much. I think it's a little BS, but my first week at Turner back in 2012, I'll never forget this. I happened to be in studio doing something totally different, but I literally bumped into Charles Barkley. And I go to introduce myself, and he goes, I know who you are, brother. Like somebody had told him that I was the new guy on the block. And he goes, welcome to the family. And I thought, whatever that means. A couple of weeks later, my parents come down for a visit, and I give them a tour of the studio, and it was on a Thursday night when the guys were working. And I introduced my parents, I'll never forget this, to Shaq and then to Charles. And Shaq and Charles both pushed me out of the way so they can go give my mother a hug. They'd known me for 5 seconds, and my family was already that important to them. I can't tell you how many great nights I've had on the road or here in Atlanta with Charles, getting career advice, just shooting the, you know what, Shaq has been great. I've done tons of shows with him, and there is literally no better human being on the earth than Ernie Johnson. My first couple of years here, I never wanted to take a day off because I always wanted to be the guy that they could call to work, right? Like I moved down here to work. I was here to do it. I wanted to get better. I wanted to get more opportunities. So I never took a day off. And a few days before my first Thanksgiving back in, so this would have been the fall of 2012, Ernie's just saying, hey, are you going back up to the Northeast to see your family for Thanksgiving? I go, no. You know, I got to work. I do that stuff. He goes, well, then you're coming to my house. You're coming to my house for Thanksgiving. I ended up not going, probably should have, but I didn't feel right about it, but it was just like the warmest feeling. And I've gone to multiple Christmas parties for Ernie at his house. And it's the coolest place to work. And when you come on the show, whether you're doing a report or an interview or you have some information, they treat you the way you'd want to be treated. Now you have to have thick skin. You got to be ready to be made fun of, but that's endearing, right? That means they like you if they're making fun of you.
Yeah. I think that's really cool to hear. Cause it does appear that there is that, that close knit relationship. So to see that it even extends outside the, what you see on camera is pretty cool.
There's nothing fake about TNT, right? Like, There's no frauds. If you're an a-hole, you're going to get called out. You're probably not going to last. You know, they just don't allow that to work at Turner. And it's just like what you see on camera is real life. There's no scripting. There's no methodology other than have fun, be real, and do what you would want to watch.
Yeah. And they're obviously all big personalities, and they're each really important to the show.
Yeah.
And I think from the outside, it seems like Ernie and Charles Barkley are kind of like the leaders of the group. Is that correct?
Yeah, but as you said, they each have their role, right? Like, you know, and I think at certain times, you know, people don't like think that they're calculated. Like I think Charles Barkley is one of the smarter people in TV that we've ever seen, right? People may think he's, you know, off the cuff and he's saying things that aren't well researched or whatever it may be, but there's a method to his madness. Ernie's definitely the conductor. That show does not work as great as Charles is. And Charles is the greatest studio analyst in the history of television sports television. That Charles does not work as effectively without Ernie. And Kenny plays his part, right? Like Kenny's bringing the nitty gritty basketball. He's won championships. He's been on really good teams, played with stars. He's there. And then Shaq has his experience and his knowledge and then his humor, right? And it all just works. And the first season, Shaq's first season at Turner was my first season at Turner. And there was a lot of people that didn't think it was going to last because let's face it, Shaq wasn't fitting in right away.
Yeah.
But sticking to the plan and developing that consistency is part of the secret science.
And I think it's funny because you talk about the amount of preparation and homework and stuff that you do before every broadcast. And then there's Barkley who like,
yeah, but people forget, like with the amount of gambling he does, you can't gamble at the rate he does or at a fraction of the rate he does without watching, right? So it may come off as if he doesn't watch a lot, but he does. He does.
Yeah. What makes you feel better when Barkley compliments your work or when he compliments your hair?
Well, my mother loves it more when he compliments my hair because my mother gets a kick out of it all the time. You know, so Barkley's got a thing. It's either he's going to make fun of my hair or he's going to call me half man, half makeup and make fun of me for wearing too much makeup. But let me just tell you, from a guy who gets his eyebrows waxed once, if not more than once a week, he's got no right to make fun of the way, you know, my makeup is applied.
Have you, you mentioned like that you've gotten to hang out with them. Do you get to have a drink with Charles Barkley on occasion?
I would say I've had one or two 1,000 drinks with Charles.
What is getting a drink with Charles Barkley like? Does he get a couple of drinks and start ranting about Skip Bayless?
No, but he'll go off on whatever topic somebody starts going on. You know, he's the mayor. He loves the hold court. I've never met a celebrity of his stature that embraces being famous more than him. And he got it from, and I had the pleasure during the NBA finals. I got invited to go to a dinner with Charles and his mentor, Michael Wilbon. And they both were at opposite heads of the table, and I was kind of in the middle, and I felt like I was watching a tennis match going back and forth between the jabs that they would take each other or that Charles would take at me. Charles explained where he got it from, which was Wilbon, of saying, listen, life could be a lot worse than people recognizing who you are, and that this could be the biggest moment of their day, if not of their year, maybe of their life, the fact that they got to meet you. So be nice, sign an autograph, take a picture, whatever it is. And he is what celebrity should be. Not to mention, like, and you almost feel bad. Like, listen, I know Charles has made a lot of money. I know he is making a lot of money, and he will continue to bring in a big income. I'm not trying to get it in his wallet, but you almost feel bad with at the rate of which he's buying drinks or food or the meal for people around him. I can't tell you the amount of times I've walked into a bar with him, or he just happened to be there and he's picking up the tab for everyone. It's wild. He is salt of the earth, genuine, as authentic as it gets, and embraces the role of which he has. He takes ownership of it. He doesn't run from it.
I feel like we've been talking about this for years already, but do you believe Barkley when he says he plans on retiring in a few seasons?
I mean, at some point, right? Like, maybe he dies on the set. I don't know.
Well, I mean, he's under contract for a while, but he right. keeps reiterating that he has no plans on seeing that 10-year deal through. Right. Can you imagine TNT's NBA coverage without Charles Barkley?
Well, first, I would like to call out a challenge to either you or to Awful Announcing, because I think that's where this challenge best lies. Somebody needs to go fact check how many times over the last 20 plus years that he has been at Turner on Inside the NBA that he has said he's not making it to the end of a contract, right? How many times has he said that? Now, you know, he's obviously getting older. We all are.
Yeah.
And I do know from a real human standpoint, from somebody who just had a kid for the first time in my life a few months ago, he just had his daughter just had her second child. So being a grandparent hit him a lot different than I think he ever expected. And I think it's a really cool moment in time to see him and knowing how much he wants to be around and available, but also he works one day a week, right? Like he could be there. Will the day come? Yes. And will Turner or, you know, whatever, we'll have to get past it. But he's the greatest there ever was. There will be nobody like him ever, because he's just such a rare breed of the fact that he was, you know, he is one of the greatest basketball players who played on the greatest basketball team ever assembled. And oh, by the way, statistically speaking, he was probably the best player on that team.
Yep.
Not to mention the personality and charisma that he has makes him, I don't know that we'll ever see anybody exactly like him. And I hope nobody tries to replicate him, because that's what made him great, was his originality.
Was there genuine concern inside the building last year that Barkley might leave for LIV Golf?
No.
No. And what about
Ernie Not for Johnson? Me. I'm speaking for myself.
Yeah, of course. I think it was over the summer. It was recently that Barkley did an interview. I don't remember who it was with, but he commented that he thought that Ernie might actually be the first person to retire from the group. So can you envision inside the NBA without Ernie?
I would hope they would change the name of the show. I would hope that they would listen. Nobody's bigger than anything, but these guys are.
Yeah.
I would hope that they change up the set so nobody has to sit in his seat. And I don't envy the person who has to be the next man or woman as the host of that show.
What makes TNT's NBA coverage so special? Because Ernie, Shaq, Kenny, Chuck, they're not just staples at TNT. They're key parts of the league still. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, what going back to last year, obviously you weren't concerned, but there was panic on social media over the thought that Barkley could leave NBA for Liv. And then you look at ESPN, they shake up their studio coverage of the NBA every single season, and nobody seems to really care about it. Even in the NFL, I don't know if there's a studio show with a personality that if that person left, it would cause the outcry that would occur if right. Charles Barkley or Ernie Johnson or anybody now at this point from inside the NBA left. So just to kind of to wrap up this long-winded question, what makes this group so special that they do have that connection to the audience?
I think it's the consistency. I think it's the fact that nobody tells Charles, Kenny, or Shaq what to say. Nobody tells Ernie what to say either, but Ernie is a part of the planning of the structure of the show. And I just think the chemistry fits. I just think for anybody who hasn't watched, and you can go check it out. I'm not being told to say this, by the way. You can go check it out streaming on Max right now. The Inside the NBA documentary that was put together. That tells the story. If you've missed it, go watch it. It's fantastic. You just get to see why these three guys, four guys work.
What was it like in 2020 being in the bubble?
It was the greatest professional experience of my career that I would never want to do again or wish upon anybody else. I think that there's still some like PTSD. I think there's still some lagging mental issues with that. I was there for more than 90 days in the inner bubble, where for the first 7 days that you were in the bubble, you could not leave your hotel room. And it was not some luxurious hotel room. Not that we had it hard, but part of it was eventually feeling and recognizing, like, you went in wondering, am I going to die? Like, because we still didn't know totally about COVID.
Yeah.
You know, in late July at that point. And then very quickly realizing that this was the safest place literally on earth. And your family and friends were all on the outside, not with this same protection, because you literally felt like there was a bubble around you. And then from a career standpoint, the stuff that we saw from before we even get to basketball, the political statements, the social unrest, the players threatening to leave at one point. And then you get to basketball, and it was some of the most competitive, best basketball we've ever seen. Like, it was phenomenal. All while, like, I get so juiced up in games. Like, last night, like, I take a deep breath right before I'm about to go on air every time. And, like, I get this calming sense over my body. It sounds so cliche and dumb and cheesy, but it's just like, I feel like I'm at home. Like, when I'm in an NBA arena with 20,000 people screaming and people going nuts. I was watching the best basketball of my life in the most sterile, weird environment ever. Like, the NBA finals are going around. Jimmy Butler's diving into, you know, the stanchion and stuff like that. And I'm like, am I really watching this? It was so surreal. It was so crazy.
Did you almost, being in one location for 90 days at that point and kind of stuck inside the bubble? And obviously there were a lot of people going through a lot of real hardships at that time. Yeah. So, like, I understand that we're talking about basketball, but still, right. Was it challenging being in one location? Like, did you lose track of time being there for 90 days?
Oh, yeah. And the craziest part is, like, during the NBA season now or before the bubble and since the bubble, like, I know what day of the week it is based on what games are on what channel, what network, right?
Right.
Like if it's a Tuesday, it's a TNT game. So I know it's Tuesday, right? Like, so I know if there's an NBA game on tonight on TNT, I know it's a Tuesday. If it's a Wednesday, Friday, I know it's an ESPN. If it's an ESPN game, I know it's a Wednesday or Friday, right? Like, so, and then, so we were on like every day of the week. I forget the exact number, but like I did something crazy. Like, I don't know, like 8 games in 4 days or 8 games. And I don't remember what it was, but like, it was a total time warp. And it got to be so like just repetitious of the same day of like, wake up, go get breakfast, you know, walk, see the same people. It felt like the movie Groundhog's Day, where like, go wake up, get breakfast at the same location, go to shoot around, talk to the same people, you know, come back, have a production meeting, get dressed, run to the bus to make sure you don't miss it. Cause if you miss it, then you're not getting to the game and there's no other way there. Get on the bus, drive the same route a million times back and forth to the arena. And then call the game. And it was the same thing over and over and over again for 90 some odd days.
One of the most memorable moments from the bubble was your interview with Jamal Murray when he became kind of overcome with emotion after, I think it was after he scored 50 points. Mm-hmm. What was going through your mind as you try to interview Jamal there and you saw the emotion?
I appreciate you saying that. It was to do what I've tried to tell young people to do for years, which is listen. You know, you're there to ask questions and listen and respond. Don't overshadow it and don't leave it. Like, there's a difference between a moment when somebody is getting emotional because they don't want to talk, and there's what he was doing, which was getting emotional because he wanted to share a message, and finding that balance and not pulling it out of him, but saying the right things to allow him to feel comfortable to say what was on his mind.
In general, what's your approach when you're doing those interviews? Like, do you look at a stat sheet first and try to come up with a question off of that? Do you have a producer feeding you a couple of question ideas? Like,
hell no.
what's your mindset when you're interviewing a player, especially when just seconds after the game, when emotions are still running high?
Yeah, there's nothing more challenging for me on the sidelines when there's a game coming right down to the wire and you don't know. Like, I'll never forget the year after the bubble, 2021 playoffs. It's game 7 of the second round series between the Bucks and the Nets, and Kevin Durant's having like one of the filthiest games I've ever seen in my life. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to interview Durant. We're about to move on to the conference finals, or Giannis, right? And they go back and forth, and like, I'm literally pacing like behind each bench, like, which side am I going to? What questions am I going to ask? And the other thing that people don't realize too, again, nothing's hard, but what people don't realize is that you don't know how many questions you're going to get, because if there's a game behind you, we've got to get out of it and go to that game, or there's something in the studio that we got to get back to, or whatever it is. So you can plan to ask 3-4 questions and only get one. You can only think you're getting one question and they're telling you to stretch and go to 5, or you don't know how long the answers are going to be and how that dictates it. So yeah, for me, it's thinking about why I'm interviewing this person. What is important about this person to this game in this situation? Tying it back to the pregame storylines, what's at stake in the game? Asking questions that are going to get real answers. And I hope people recognize I'm not afraid to ask hard, challenging questions on live TV. And sometimes keep it lighthearted. If there's something funny that happens, then address it. If there's something serious in nature that needs to be addressed, address it. And paying attention to the game, right? Like, paying attention to the game as to, again, why we are interviewing that person at that time. Make it relevant. And give the person at home, like, I approach anything I do as if I was on the couch and what I would want to know from that game, from that person. So just because you're at the game shouldn't change your mentality.
How have your interactions with Greg Popovich been?
I was just with him last night. He's a chipper young man. Good. You know, I'm sure you're referring to back, I think it was in 2015 or something. You know, what people don't realize about him is, and I'm not letting him off the hook because I think he needs to be held a little bit more, I don't know about accountable, but people need to call him on the carpet a little bit more. Off of live television, he's a sweet man and he's nice. And we get the coolest thing that we get as a national partner with the NBA is we get a few minutes off the record mandated with each coach before each game we do on TNT. So like last night, spent 15 minutes with Mark Daigneault, spent 15 minutes with Greg Popovich. And in those instances, he is giving us a lot of content, a lot of good information, some of which we can use on the air, a lot of which we can't use on the air. And it's much different than his public persona. I wish at times he wasn't as condescending. I wish at times I think he's hypocritical in sometimes he charges the media with taking the game too seriously. And then if you take it too lightly, he wants to know why you're not taking it more seriously. I think that he sets you up in whatever corner he wants to be in. I wish the whole San Antonio organization would embrace the media, particularly their broadcast partners who are essentially funding a big part of the league, that we are partners and not enemies, and that working together creates better content for the viewer and the fan. It becomes a better experience. And I also think too, and I should ask Pop at some point the next time I see him, like those sideline interviews, coaches interviews at the end of quarters that he became so famous for, first with Craig Sager and then with David Aldridge and then Doris Burke and me, and you know, I'm not throwing myself in that category, obviously, but I've done those and he's sometimes been a jerk and sometimes been nice. But what I'm curious to know if he recognized that by him making it such a spectacle made the NBA want to continue to do it.
Yeah.
Right. It became something that, like, we never tease any interviews that we're about to go do something, but like ESPN and TNT would go to break at the end of the third quarter and saying, coming up next, what's Greg Popovich going to say to Craig Sager? You know, stay tuned for that. Or people on Twitter are all like, oh, Pop's going to do an interview here. Let's sit and watch. And sometimes it was eventful and sometimes there was nothing there. But by him doing that, it made it an event. So I just wonder, like, it was to me counterintuitive. If he didn't like doing the interviews, he didn't want to do it, he should have said nothing. He should have just gave a couple word answers and made it boring and vanilla, and there'd be no entertainment value. And maybe we wouldn't still be doing it, you know, 10 years later.
Yeah, no, he definitely, he gave the potential for kind of teasing that there could be a unique interaction as opposed to just standard traditional coach speak.
Yes.
Do you have, is there somebody, a player or a coach who you would consider the toughest to interview?
Toughest. I don't know about toughest.
How about favorite? Is there a favorite player or coach to whether retired or current, somebody that you've kind of felt that they gave really good answers, really enjoyed the interactions?
I think one of the most thoughtful people in the league is Steph Curry. He listens to your questions. He takes this pregnant pause to digest your question, think about the answer, and then give you. And he's always like doing the eye contact thing, you know, engages you by using your name. And I just think I think Steph Curry gets it. Like he totally gets it. I gotta think about the toughest though. I mean, that's a tough question.
I have to also ask about, Kevin Durant and that, the interaction a couple of years ago, with the, did you ever think you'd be this good question? Did you walk away from that exchange wishing you asked a different question, or were you okay with it because Durant did give a notable response?
Yeah, I didn't love the way I framed the question, but what confused me in the moment was that I was complimenting him.
Yeah.
that it was, you know, a year or two, whatever it was, since he had ruptured his Achilles, and now he's, you know, the best player on the court with a reigning MVP in Giannis Antetokounmpo, right? And I just want to say, later on, he recognized that he came off not great, and Durant did pull me aside and say, "Hey, we good?" And I said, "Yeah." Mm. Those moments happen, right? Yeah. And you know, I think Kevin Durant has actually gotten. I was just thinking about this yesterday because I was in Oklahoma City. He's become a pretty thoughtful person in his answers too over the years. And, you know, obviously he's the whole Twitter thing and all this other stuff that he does. That's a separate issue. But I don't think, you know, he challenges you a lot like Greg Popovich to come up with good questions. And if you ask a yes or no question, you're setting yourself up for failure. And in that instance, I probably should have framed the question differently. But in the end, it was still like, dude, you ruptured your Achilles, and now you're like, you might be the best player in the NBA again. And we don't see that happen in sports.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the exchange was awkward. It was a potentially yes or no question, but at the same time, he did give an answer that kind of, like, it was a passionate response that he, yeah. if the answer was going to be, yeah, I thought that I could do this, as opposed to like, are you kidding me? Like, yes, of course I thought I could do this.
And the big thing, like the biggest thing I've learned over my 13 seasons covering the NBA every single day, and it almost seems obvious, but you really have to get it. Like, there's a different mentality when you're talking about professional athletes. And then what I really learned from getting to work with Shaq and Charles Barkley, and then covering the greats like Kobe and LeBron and Steph, is that that mentality that's different about NBA players is even more different for the all-time greats. Like, the margins of their athletic or basketball ability are tiny in terms of being better than just an all-star player. It's their mentality, it's their work ethic, it's their approach. And Kevin Durant, in that answer, I think was telling me and the world, yeah, I was one of the best players to ever play before. Why wouldn't I be great now? Not allowing himself to enter his mind that he suffered one of the most devastating injuries.
Did you get to interview Kobe?
Oh yeah. I did.
What was that? Cause like, he's somebody that I would imagine it's almost, it would take a little bit for him to kind of like get out of game mode and turn off the emotion.
So I'll tell you, the last time I interviewed Kobe, it was like, totally to your point, Brandon, I was doing a radio show on Sirius XM NBA radio with Rick Fox. We did this for a couple of years, several years ago, and it was Kobe's last season. And Rick and I are talking like, we got to get Kobe on. And Rick texts me one day, "Hey, Kobe's going to call in whatever day it was to the show." And I looked at the schedule. I'm like, "There's no way, Rick. It's the Lakers are playing." He goes, "Yeah, he's going to do it." I go, "Okay, whatever." So literally, I think it was like right at the beginning of the show too, whatever, we come out at 1 o'clock, it was like 1:05, and Kobe calls in, and he's in a car. He's like driving in. I don't remember what the situation was, but I one of my questions to him was like, who is, I got to find the archive of this. I said to him, "Who is this Kobe? You're talking to us. You're joking around. You're having fun with, listen, he's got great respect for Rick Fox, but like, I'm some schmo. Like, why are you talking to us right now, getting ready for a game?" And I think we just saw an evolution of Kobe. There was a different guy. There was a soft, and not softer in terms of like on the basketball court, not the killer mentality that he had, but like softer in terms of his interactions with human beings, recognizing at this point in his life that relationships were slightly more important than he allowed them to be while he was trying to become the greatest basketball player he could. And it was such a fascinating interview. And then it ended up picking steam because he talked about what he wanted to do after playing basketball. And that was a really cool interview.
I forgot that you did the radio show with Rick Fox. What was it like watching the news of Kobe Bryant's death and the sort of rush by various journalists and outlets to hastily report information?
Yeah.
And then you having to dispel the report that Rick Fox was in that helicopter with Kobe.
Yeah, that was one of the toughest days ever. It's crazy. So I texted Rick relatively quickly into the news starting to leak out from TMZ that day that something had happened with Kobe. And I can't remember if we talked or we were just texting. And I was the one that told Rick. So Rick is crushed, devastated. And texting back and forth with Rick. And then like an hour or two later, stuff starts coming out on Twitter, like you said, that Rick was in the helicopter. And now I'm trying to get a hold of Rick. And Rick is freaking out because his kids, before they've spoken to Rick, are seeing the news. And so I was just so angry that I just put out that tweet without even like looking at it twice, looking for spelling or am I framing this the right way? Like I think back, like I would have liked to have framed that tweet a little bit differently, but I was just like so angry that people could be so reckless. And listen, we could talk about journalistic integrity or ethics. Like 101 is, if you did not get the information yourself, you do not then spread said information. And it was devastating because now Rick is dealing with the loss of one of his dearest friends and daughter. And trying to calm his own family down because they think he's dead. I couldn't even imagine going through what Rick had to go through that day. I just felt so awful. I was full of rage. I could not believe what people were doing.
How were the emotions at inside the NBA after that?
So we were getting ready to debut our brand new Tuesday lineup. So I was on the air at NBA TV on Sunday night. I went in to go do the night shift. I don't even know if I was on the schedule that day, but I went in to go do the night shift and work. And then the next day on Monday, I was flying to Miami. It was the first night that I was going to be part of this brand new Tuesday night lineup. And I was working with Brian Anderson and Jim Jackson, and we didn't know if we were going to do the game. We didn't know if the league was going to play. So I just flew to Miami, not knowing whether we were going to have a game, whether it was going to be on TNT, whatever it was. And then the Clipper Laker game was supposed to be the second half of our doubleheader. And obviously, as everybody knows, they decided not to play the Clipper Laker game, but the Inside the NBA crew still did the show from the court at then Staples Center. And it was just such a weird game. Like it was truly one of the, it was supposed to, for me, like selfishly, it was one of the career highlights for me. I was part of this new TV package on TNT, and I'm at this game, and all anybody's thinking about is Kobe. And it was the Celtics at the Heat, and Jason Tatum was really close with Kobe, so like he's emotional about whether he wants to play. And then I interview Gordon Hayward for the walk-off interview, and Gordon was on the Utah Jazz in that final game against Kobe that he ever played. So it was just another surreal experience where you're balancing like, how much do we talk this game? How much do we talk Kobe? It was a wild experience. And I just think that's where TNT shines. Our, the guy who used to run Inside the NBA, Tim Kiley, and Jeremy Levin, who produced it for a long time. Those guys just They get it. They knew how to do, they know how to do TV. And, you know, I was proud to be on that team that night.
Are you still in touch with Rick Fox? I feel like he's somebody that when he was playing, people would have predicted that he would have had a long, flourishing media career. And I'm sure if he wanted to, he probably could, just based on the fact that he was like acting while playing and stuff like that.
Right.
But he never really, it didn't quite take off, at least his TV career.
Yeah. I wish I could say I chatted with Rick more frequently, but he is like one of the busiest men, I think, in the world right now. And as we speak, I think he's doing some sort of world tour. And if you check out his Instagram, he does a vlog every day about what he's doing. But he's got his hand. He has become one of the smartest businessmen. He was involved. I think he still is involved in like e-gaming. I love Rick. He is great. Him and I have worked a lot together. We've had great moments together. Watched one of the great Super Bowls with Rick Fox when the Patriots came back from being down against the Falcons. Him and I watched it with then my girlfriend, who is now my wife. At an Atlanta hotel lobby. And Rick is a huge New England Patriots fan, only makes sense because everything for him works out well, right? Like he grows up, plays basketball in the state of Indiana, which is the greatest high school basketball state in the country, goes to North Carolina, plays for Dean Smith, right? Goes to the Celtics, and then they decide that they're ready to move on for him. So where do they send him? The Lakers, right? So he's got all that. He's, you know, we all know what his love life has looked like. It hasn't hurt him, right, over there. He's on all these TV shows. And oh, by the way, yeah, I'm a Patriots fan too. Yeah, right. So I watched that game with him. That was not that I had any rooting interest, but I just didn't want the Patriots to win. So
yeah, and in an Atlanta hotel, also right. Rooting for the Patriots.
Crazy,
that
yeah.
Kind of turnaround is pretty insane. You grew up in New Jersey. Were you a Knicks fan or a Nets fan?
Nets fan.
Nets fan. How old are you?
I just turned 40.
Okay. So the Jason Kidd years were like prime rooting years, like late teens.
Yeah. But that was weird years, right? Like it was fun to be, well, not fun, but like self-torture to be a Nets fan in like the 90s. Like I started going to games in the Kenny Anderson, Derek Coleman era, but I was more so like the Benoit Benjamin, Chris Morris era, right? Like Rex Walters was my favorite Net ever. Jason Williams was one of my favorite Nets. So like it was weird being a Nets fan with them going to back-to-back finals because we were supposed to be like, you know, you kind of enjoyed being, you know, the laughing stock of the NBA because I'm messed up mentally.
How is it now getting to work with Ian Eagle?
Dude, it is. I keep on using the word surreal. I'm just so fortunate. So when I was 14 years old, I tapped Ian on the shoulder at a Nets game and said, I'm going to do this one day. And Ian is, I'm sure you've heard this story. I know you've interviewed Ian. He the amount of time he gives to young people is unbelievable. Like if he charged just a dollar for the amount of time he did, he would literally be a multi-millionaire just on that stuff. He's too generous with his time. And I was annoying. I'm still annoying. And he was great with me all throughout high school. And then in college, Ian was calling Jets preseason games. And I was at Hofstra where the Jets practiced on our campus during my time there.
Yeah.
So I would literally drive over to the Jets facility. And when he was done doing his coaches' interviews, preparing for that preseason game, he would sit in my car in my passenger seat and I'd put a CD in and he would listen to my football tape and critique me. So having Ian do that, mentor me, talk me through career advice, have me, you know, be somebody that was mentoring me all throughout college, getting out of college. He was somebody I consulted before I went to Turner to start working on the NBA TV side. And then literally, you know, so that was, you know, I was 14. And then when I'm like 37, 36, I'm now working with him on NBA games on TNT. It's wild. The first time he tossed to me, I had like an out-of-body experience. It's awesome. And he is, I think, he's the best. He's the best human. And you know, I know how you guys at Awful Announcing feel about Ian. Just his calls on football and basketball are out of this world.
Yeah, tremendous. Absolutely. Before I let you go, what am I supposed to make of the in-season tournament? Like, what do the players make of the in-season tournament? Do these games mean more to them?
Yeah, I don't know if it means more right now. I think once we get to the next round, the knockout round, where if you win, you'll have the opportunity to go to Vegas for the semifinals. I think that's where something you'll start to feel something different, as opposed to just see something different with the court and the uniforms being different. But like we talked about on the broadcast on TNT last night with Stan Van Gundy, what do you have to lose? I don't understand anybody who's knocking this, because it's still a regular season game on top of being an in-season tournament game. You're not taking anything away from the regular season. There's just a chance, and the NBA has admitted this, a small chance that this sticks and this is something good. Or maybe they make tweaks to it. Maybe they make big adjustments to it. Maybe they totally make it go away. But what's the harm in trying something new to get people to care a little bit more about November basketball and December basketball than they have in previous years? I just don't see what the harm in is.
Yeah, to me, it feels like something that's going to get tweaked, but I think it does. It is a potential moneymaker, so like I have a hard time believing that they're going to end up just getting rid of it altogether. I'd say, like, do you think 10 years from now we're going to be watching the in-season tournament and excited about it, or 10 years from now the in-season tournament is going to be a sort of figment of our imagination?
Yeah, I don't think it's the exact same version that it is today, but I absolutely 100% believe that 10 years from now, some sort of in-season tournament is wildly popular.
Jared, you were fantastic. Thank you so much for joining the podcast. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you getting word out about Crunch Time too.
Of course.
We need all the viewers we can get, but it's a really special product. And I just hope people recognize, like, if you're not a hardcore basketball fan, the show is for you. If you're a hardcore basketball fan, the show is for you. If you're gambling on basketball, the show is for you. If you are watching another game or watching something else on your main TV, put us on a second screen. The show is for you. It's so unique. It's different than any other whip around show. I hope people check it out.
That is Jared Greenberg. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Please rate and subscribe to this podcast. Please also subscribe to Awful Announcing's YouTube page. But regardless of how you consume Awful Announcing and the Awful Announcing podcast, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at awfulannouncing.com.